Hi, I'm Dr. Peter Keenan. I'm a neuropsychologist at Marshfield Clinic.
I'm Colette Song, Community Resources Social Worker at Marshfield Clinic.
Jennifer Sackett with the EDRC of the Northwoods.
Julie St. Pierre, Community Outreach Specialist with the Alzheimer's Association Greater Wisconsin Chapter.
And thanks to all of you for coming today. And we have a lot of topics to get to. Let's start first with, what are the facts? Why are we hearing so much about Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Who wants to take that?
Well, I think I can go ahead and start with that question. I think that the reason we're starting to hear more and more about Alzheimer's disease is because we're seeing so many people be diagnosed. Just a few years ago, the baby boom generation started turning the age of 65, and we know that typical onset Alzheimer's increases in prevalence after the age of 65. So we now have this tsunami of baby boomers that have reached the age at which they're at greatest risk for developing Alzheimer's. So since we have so many more people at risk, we are having a lot more conversations about what the disease is and how it impacts people.
Dr. Keenan, what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
So that's a great question and one I'm asked a lot. Doctors need a term for something that if a person's brain health changes so much that they have difficulty functioning independently, they need a name for that, and that is a dementia. And so there are different kinds of things that can cause changes to the health of the brain. So a person could have a traumatic brain injury or a stroke or Alzheimer's disease, but any of those conditions could cause enough changes in brain health that that person has trouble living on their own, or, you know, doing routine things like managing their medications. So when a person gets to that point that their brain is no longer allowing them to live independently, that is what we would call a dementia. Alzheimer's disease is a common health concern that can cause changes in the brain and thus cause a dementia. So dementia, or the ability to not live independently any longer, is a common result of Alzheimer's disease, but they are different.
How is the brain different, or is it how is the brain at that point?
With Alzheimer's disease?
Yes.
So with Alzheimer's disease, the early issues start in terms of memory, and not so much memory from long ago, but recent memory, like what you did yesterday or last week. It's the new information, and the brain has more and more difficulty storing and holding on to that information. So when it goes to remember things later, if they haven't been stored or just aren't there, then the memory difficulties could really affect how a person's doing, make it hard for them to remember if they've taken their medications or if they've paid their bills or remember the things that they were supposed to do in that day. So as those memory difficulties increase, as the disease increases, then the person has more difficulty living on their own and will need more help from other people.
Let's say the scan of the brain, do they look different? How does the brain look?
That's a good question. Alzheimer's disease tends to affect the areas of the brain first that are responsible for memory. And again, putting memory into storage, so to speak. So taking what's going on around you and holding on to it for later. And those areas are on the sides of your head, kind of just above your ears. And so the biggest change we would see on some kinds of neuroimaging is that that area would have tissue loss, so that there would be less brain there because that part of the brain is losing cells. More generally, you would see some general tissue loss, so that overall the brain is smaller, which if that happens too much, that's not so good because your brain is helping you to think and to make sense of the world. And so if you're losing too many of your brain cells, that could really affect how you're doing day to day.
Colette, anything you would like to add at this point?
As Dr. Keenan talked about, when people are starting to have trouble functioning at home, managing those day-to-day things are often the areas of daily life that I provide information and resources. And we also like to provide education on what to expect in the future, how that particular dementia may progress, things to look for and plan in the future.
Okay. What population and genders are affected most by dementia?
I think the biggest risk factor that we all share is getting older. And as Julie pointed out in the beginning, that we're living longer. And so in the past, we didn't have people living too far past 65, but now we're seeing what can happen to the brain in those later decades of life. And Alzheimer's disease is unfortunately one of the processes or diseases that can affect the brain more clearly as we get into our 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. And because that it takes a while for this condition to emerge and to become apparent and to really have the symptoms show up, the biggest risk factor is aging, because that allows enough time for the disease to really take hold and start to cause problems for a person. So I think gender breakdown, there's not any real compelling research on Alzheimer's disease itself. So I wouldn't expect a man to be more likely than a woman to show any difference, or vice versa. I believe the same is true of race, although feel free to correct me on that.
I think you're correct in that. I think sometimes we do see maybe slightly more women be diagnosed just because of longer life expectancy, living a little bit longer. So they are at a little bit greater risk for developing Alzheimer's. And we know that age is that number one risk factor, but we like to also make people aware that Alzheimer's really doesn't care how old somebody is when it strikes them. So we do oftentimes see more than we would like to people in their 40s, 50s, early 60s be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And I think that it's not necessarily that there's more people developing Alzheimer's at a younger age as much as there's increased awareness that Alzheimer's can affect people at younger ages. I think 10 years ago, 15 years ago, if someone who was 50 years old or 55 years old went to the doctor and had some of the warning signs for Alzheimer's, they may not have considered that as a possible diagnosis. So I think there's greater awareness of a younger onset Alzheimer's that can affect people at those younger ages as well.
Jennifer, you were nodding in agreement. What's been your experience?
I think what I've seen through the ADRC and Department on Aging, there are more people in general that we're seeing, families concerned about their loved one, whether it's a husband, wife, parent, you know, an aunt, an uncle, that they're having more difficulties living independently. One thing that I've seen is there's a lot of people that don't want to admit that there's a problem. Mm-hmm. They want things to be the way they were, but they're not anymore. There's a lot of the caregivers, the family members, that get angry with the people, their loved one, that have the dementia or Alzheimer's, and it's really hard for them to accept or realize that it's not the person, their loved one, isn't forgetting things on purpose. They aren't not taking their medicine because they don't want to. They're not taking their medicine because they have a health issue that is preventing them from being able to do those things.
I'll let you were shaking your head too.
Yeah, I agree with what Jenny said, that oftentimes people can mask these symptoms for a long time, or their significant other compensates. And then when it advances, then people are starting to notice a little bit more, but they tend to minimize, saying, oh, you know, it's just general forgetfulness, it's not a big deal. these loved ones, they look normal. They look like they always have, but their brain isn't thinking the same. But the families tend to expect that they can still problem solve, have insight, be able to make decisions the way that they always have their whole life. And so there is often a little bit of denial or minimizing the seriousness of these memory issues and how it impacts the person in their daily life.
And we've had a couple of issues here in the North recently of people who just go, you know, they go out and they're out and they're on their own in the cold and so on. Is this what you're referring to, this type of?
Certainly the potential for wandering or getting lost, people's reaction time when they're driving and giving up the car is a really big, it affects daily life and the person's independence when we talk about the driving issues. But it's medication safety. It's are they eating and remembering to eat, because their hunger pains are a little bit different, that they don't recognize that they're hungry. They don't recall how to use the microwave or heat up the stove to prepare food. And so it impacts all aspects of their daily life.
Or they forget to turn off the stove.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which creates, you know, a dangerous situation. So sometimes families go into the house and they will unplug the stove or you know, and then it's one more thing, one more service, one more thing that someone else has to come in and provide, whether it's a family member that comes and brings meals, or if they get home delivered, you know, meals on wheels, whatever the case may be, it's another thing that somebody else has to help them with.
I think one thing I would add to is not only can sometimes the family members get concerned or frustrated because their loved one is acting differently or isn't doing things the way that they used to be able to do, and that's hard to make sense of. I think the flip side can be true also, because the problems that a person is having with their memory or other parts of their thinking and decision making, you know, the things that make you have trouble taking your medications consistently or remembering to pay bills also make it hard for you to recognize that you're struggling with that and that you need help. And so if the disease has really taken hold and affected a person's faculties, then they might not recognize, why is my daughter or son trying to help me with my finances? They might not be able to put those pieces together the way that they used to, or remember the conversation that they had about finances and why they need help now. And so sometimes we can see some pushback from the individual with Alzheimer's pushing the caregivers away because they don't have that insight or perspective that some others have that they need help. So that can be, I think, a really mm-hmm. challenging situation for the patient and the family, because the dynamics that they've had for a long time about what it means to be the dad or the mom in their family, those change, and that's hard for both the individual and the family. There's a lot of transitions there.
Mm-hmm. I think that family members want the parent to continue in that role and have a say and maintain their independence. And so it can be very challenging to open the door for conversation about how are the finances, how are you doing with things? And then when they do start to take over, then it creates extra tension between the person with Alzheimer's and the family, because of, you know, their thinking is clear sometimes and not clear sometimes. Mm-hmm. They may start misplacing things, and then paranoia can come in, that who's stealing these things, who's coming in. And that makes it hard for family members and the patient or the person with Alzheimer's as well, because everything is confusing now and it's hard to keep it all straight.
I think one thing that can be very helpful for families in this process is understanding what kind of changes are normal to memory and what are the symptoms of something more serious. I think that's why having a diagnosis is very important, because families themselves are wondering, is this normal? Is this not normal? you know, how much is, how, what does this compare to typical age-related changes to memory? And when families are able to come to experts like Dr. Keenan and obtain a diagnosis, it is somewhat empowering them for them then to be able to step in and know that they're doing appropriate things at appropriate times. And I know a number of the families that I have worked with through my work with the Alzheimer's Association over the years, where they found the diagnosis particularly helpful because it doesn't just show which areas people are struggling, but it also shows what their areas of strength are that they still have, so that they're able to the best of their ability, to continue to involve that person in planning for themselves and getting their input and knowing that they're helping in appropriate places. Because I think that families are in an oftentimes in a difficult position of not wanting to take over too much. And when we see them being afraid to help with things, then people aren't getting the assistance they need. So kind of having that diagnosis and that understanding of what stage somebody is at in the illness can be helpful for families in knowing exactly what kind of help is needed, what degree of help is needed. But then it also allows them to think down the road for long-term planning in terms of, okay, I don't need to assist with this right now, but 2 months from now, 6 months from now, this may be a different picture and I need to be prepared to step in and help with those things.
So when a person has an earlier diagnosis, they are able to help with the planning of what they want in their future. So if they want to go to assisted living, if they want to go to a nursing home, who will be able to help with finances? Who will be able to help with meal preparation? You know, can I live with my daughter? Can I live with my son? Where would I want to, you know, move when I get to the point where I can't be independent?
You're listening to a program here on WXPR involving Alzheimer's and dementias, involving a panel of experts here. And here on WXPR, local public radio, is a good point. Julie, you had brought up diagnosis and treatment. I'd like to back up just a little bit, and let's talk a little bit about what are the signs and symptoms. And Dr. Keenan, you might want to begin that.
Really, the earliest signs tend to occur in the area of memory, at least with Alzheimer's disease. And so what we would initially see is memory being less reliable. And so a person's ability to remember details about recent events or conversations, things like that, which I think is tricky for people because that early part is hard to distinguish from sometimes the forgetfulness that we all experience.
I wanted to bring that up because I think every person, the minute that they all of a sudden can't remember something, they're starting to think, oh, I'm going down the slippery slope. No, there's a difference, right?
Yeah, and some of that is kind of what kind of difficulties you're having, which would be something that would be looked at in a more detailed assessment. I think the biggest, red flag would be if those memory difficulties increase over time, that it's not just an intermittent thing that happens. You know, I forgot where I parked my vehicle, where are my keys? We can all do that. But I think if that happens too much and it starts to happen more often, that could be a sign of concern. But there are a lot of different things that can affect memory and those kinds of abilities. So it wouldn't necessarily just be Alzheimer's, which would be another reason to get things looked at or consult with your primary care provider and get a sense of is this a concern and what kind of next steps you should take. But again, memory would be the earliest signs of a concern.
I know that when I'm talking with families and they have concerns and their question is, you know, is what I'm seeing in my husband a little bit more than what I might expect, or is it about what I would expect? I always, this is highly scientific here, I say listen to the little voice in the back of your head that says something's not right. I think that's something that if you have that thought that, oh, something doesn't seem quite right, I encourage people at that point in time to talk to their doctor just to find out what is going on, because it could be the medications that they're taking. It could be undiagnosed, untreated sleep disorders. It could be nutritional deficiencies. It could be depression. There's so many things that can affect how our memory functions that you want to make sure that they're ruling out anything reversible and treatable that can be going on. But I think we would probably see more people diagnosed at earlier stages if they listen to that voice in the back of their head that says, I think this is something more than just normal age-related changes. So I know that's highly scientific, but that's a rule of thumb that I use to families. If that thought is there, it's time to talk to the doctor about what they're seeing.
Typically, what goes on during an assessment?
Essentially, there would be three parts. The first part would be gathering background and context. We could do all the testing in the world with someone, and it's not really helpful if we don't have it in an informed and meaningful context. And so that would be the first part. So I would be looking at the patient's medical records, talking with the patient about what they're noticing that they're concerned about, and as well as what's going well. And that would kind of allow us to know where to emphasize things in terms of the testing or get a sense of how they're doing with some of those things that Colette had mentioned, like medications, finances, driving, how are those things going as well, beyond just forgetfulness. The testing that I do, I think, well, neuropsychology, I think, would be one perspective in this, that there's different ways of knowing how someone's doing. So you can get a blood test, you know, for some things. You can have neuroimaging done to have a picture of your brain to see how the brain health looks. What our testing offers is a sense of how the brain is functioning in terms of the things it needs to do day to day. So we're asking the person to do tasks or answer questions that pull on functions like attention, their ability to remember things, their ability to problem solve or reason through things, looking at the different things that the brain does for us. And by doing that, we can get a sense of how the person is doing. Are they showing difficulties that are consistent with a problem like Alzheimer's disease? And then what recommendations might we have for that person? Of course, at the end, after gathering all of this information, it's important to sit down, talk about how things look, and make recommendations for next steps. So that could be a recommendation to someone like Colette or to the Alzheimer's Association for additional information, or it could be to our colleagues over at the Aging and Disability Resource Centers to get them plugged in with resources. So that's what a person could expect from a neuropsychological evaluation.
If somebody is just having, you know, I'm having memory issues, that's what we usually hear. I can't remember things. What the ADRC can do is we can do a mini COG test. I'm not going to go into what the details are of that. That'll give it all away. We can come in to their home and we can do that mini test to see if it looks like there's memory impairments. And then what we do is we can refer them to see someone at the memory clinic, see Dr. Keenan, see, you know, whoever they choose to go see.
So you might be the first person to see.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So the one thing I want to mention is that dementia impairs thinking processes. So it's memory is the first thing that people notice usually, but it affects judgment, attention, perception, reasoning skills, their organizational skills, memory, of course, their ability to communicate, abstract thinking, their orientation to time and place, awareness of social appropriate norms, and also the ability to filter emotional responses. So they may get really angry about something that really doesn't matter. They may start crying. There's all different sorts of things. But those are the main things that dementia will impair.
And I think one thing I would point out with that is that, yeah, that's absolutely right, that there's different aspects of thinking that can be affected. And those are different, or the emphasis of what they're struggling with, I think, is different from or between Alzheimer's disease and other conditions. So what one kind of issue might affect is different than Alzheimer's disease. And the way that you would want to approach that treatment-wise or information-wise would also be different. And so I think that can be some of the utility to getting a name to things, to understand what is this that I'm dealing with, so that I can have the right tools and information to make choices about my future.
Colette, what happens at this point? What is your service?
So at Marshfield Clinic and Minocqua Center, we are in the process of developing a memory diagnostic clinic. What Dr. Keenan does is part of it. So there are patients who go to him for just the regular neuropsychological testing, but we also have patients that come to our memory clinic, which involves a multidisciplinary team approach with Dr. Keenan, an internal medicine physician, Dr. Gabert is on our team, and myself as a social worker. And so the memory clinic is a little bit, because of the multidisciplinary approach, I look at things from the psychosocial aspects. When Dr. Keenan is testing the patients, I'm meeting with a family member to get a little bit more background on what they're doing or what they're seeing. So we're not only just getting the patient's perspective, we're getting the family input on things that they've noticed. And then through the internal medicine, Dr. Gabert's role is also looking at any other potential underlying medical conditions. And then, so after the testing is done, our clinic runs a couple of hours for all of us to do our assessments. We meet as a team with the patient and their family to give them the diagnosis, to talk about next steps, to recommend whatever treatments, medications, or plans should be. We address advanced care planning. We address any other kind of resources that the patient or family might need. During that course of assessment, when we find out they are struggling with certain aspects, maybe we talk about Meals on Wheels, maybe we talk about the resources through both the Alzheimer's Association and the ADRC, the social services, and various other programs to help make sure that they feel supported, that they don't have to go through this journey on their own. Also, we do education. So this is what the diagnosis is. This is what the future may hold. We give them written information. I often will meet with them afterwards to kind of help them process, and because it's a lot of information in one day. And so it's like, okay, they can only absorb so much. So then we meet again to kind of help them process and then review any additional needs that they may have. If they do not have a power of attorney for healthcare on file, we try to get that done right away if that window of opportunity is there. Sometimes, by the time we've done the testing, it's beyond that point that their memory is too impaired and we cannot do advanced care planning, and we may need to encourage them and walk them through the process of guardianship, which we want to avoid the completion of power of attorney and other advanced directives like financial directives, which often people will think about doing the healthcare directive, but they forget the financial piece. And then when that person's memory gets beyond that point that they can manage their finances, now all of a sudden the family's in a pickle because they can't access the bank accounts, they can't deal with insurances, they can't do any of those business matters to help make sure that the person is getting the care that they need.
And I imagine in many cases you might find that they haven't thought about this process very much. Is that accurate?
Very accurate.
Very accurate.
Okay. So when you hear, explain just briefly, either anyone, I guess, power of attorney. So in case somebody doesn't know what that is and why it's important.
Power of attorney for healthcare is to make decisions for you if you are, I want to say decided, but that's not the correct term. But if you, two doctors or a doctor and a psychologist determine that you are not able to make your own healthcare decisions, that's where the power of attorney for healthcare would come in. What you would do is you fill out the power of attorney for healthcare. You decide what you want. Do you want to be kept on life support? Do you want a feeding tube? Do you, you know, there's all different sorts of things. When you are determined that you're not capable of doing that anymore, the people that you, the agent that you choose is who is able to make that decision. So that's power of attorney for healthcare. That is not, just because someone has a power of attorney for healthcare does not mean that that person can make their decisions. That person only makes those decisions once they are deemed incompetent.
Incapacitated.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a really excellent way to let your family and loved ones know that what your preferences are on some of these complex health issues. And that's so important, because if a person, you know, has serious cognitive changes from Alzheimer's or just a sudden accident, then it's great for family members to know these were their desires and wishes. And that way they can, you know, honor those as best as possible.
Everybody over the age of 18 should have a healthcare power of attorney.
Yes, they should.
We often wait until we're older or have serious health conditions. But in the state of Wisconsin, we are not what's called a next of kin state. We have a misunderstanding that because I'm married, my husband has the right to make healthcare decisions, or my family knows what my wishes are. But unless they put it in writing who they want to make decisions and how they want those decisions to be made, your family can't do that. And so we recommend everybody over the age of 18 complete these directives. Car accidents happen, things happen that we don't anticipate, and then you're unable to make decisions. The healthcare team doesn't know what to do. It's very difficult to withdraw life-prolonging and life-sustaining treatment without these types of written directives. So they're very important for everybody to do. So people often wait and wait, and then memory impairments come in, and then it may be too late that some of these decisions have to be made, and that's when guardianship needs to come in. And that's a process where the family needs to hire an attorney and go through the court process. The judge determines who makes decisions and how those, some of those decisions are made at a financial cost to the family. Where if they complete a healthcare directive, power of attorney for healthcare, when they're still able to understand and make decisions, it's easier and less stressful, less burdensome emotionally and financially on everybody.
Yeah, I think it's a great investment in time that it's a big deal to have it filled out. It's very important, but it really wouldn't take most people more than an hour. And the forms are fairly easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And I think saving or investing that hour or less in thinking about your future and preferences can save your family countless hours of worry and a lot of money in the long run. So I think it's a really wise thing to do for anybody.
Yeah, 18, as soon as you turn 18, but, it's a good to have those things in place.
But back to our conversation about Alzheimer's, I think certainly if there was concern about changes in a person's functioning and Alzheimer's was starting to be suspected, that would be a critical time to fill out that paperwork while the person is still able to really think through and make those decisions.
I have a suspicion, however, as much as you say 18, that there's the majority of the public, they don't think about that until later. Am I accurate in that? Mm-hmm.
60, 70.
Well, and I think people sometimes are intimidated by the terminology that you use and assume, oh, you hear power of attorney for healthcare, I have to run to an attorney to get this done, and it's going to cost me money, and I don't want to do that because attorneys are expensive. So that's a question that I get all the time, so maybe I can ask that one to the panel. Where do we send people if they want help with that power of attorney for healthcare?
So certainly that's a role that I play at Marshfield Clinic. I help people do power of attorney forms almost every day. It is a free service that we provide. Most hospitals, most clinics have somebody that can help complete those documents. The ADRC has staff, social services has staff, so there's a lot of people in the area that can help. You also can go to an attorney, and a lot of people will go to do their estate planning and take care of financial directives and healthcare directives all at the same time. We in healthcare do not do the financial documents. We do not do any of those other legal documents, but we do the healthcare directives all the time.
And you can actually, if you need copies of the advanced directives, the ADRC can print them off for you and give them to you. Or if you have access to the internet, you go to Wisconsin Power of Attorney, and the financial power of attorney and the healthcare power of attorney will both come up.
Before we go on, tell people where the ADRC is located.
The ADRC of the Northwoods has 5-6 locations. There's one in Rhinelander, and we are at the Senior Center right across from Triggs. Vilas County has one. They just moved to the new addition of the courthouse. Crandon has one right on Main Street. We cover the Potawatomi tribe, and that is right in the Health and Wellness Building. We have one in Taylor County, which is right on Broadway. And then we also have one up in Lac de Flambeau at the Health and Wellness Center.
Let's move back. We wandered off into the legal area a little bit, but it's a very important aspect of it. But let's get back a little bit to the stages of Alzheimer's disease. And it's a spectrum, I guess. Would that be an accurate way to describe it?
Yeah, it's what we refer to as a progressive condition. So it's gradually changing over time as the health of the person's brain is changing over time. And this happens really slowly. It can creep up on you at first, but then the changes continue to occur over the course of months and years. You know, you wouldn't typically be the same one day to the next, but you would have changes in how you're doing in terms of memory and other abilities over, you know, the course of months and years.
I've heard stories that there's not a lot that can be done, but are there medicines? Is there anything that can help at this point?
I think in terms of the benefits of getting diagnosed and what that can plug you into, I think we've referenced the information piece. From a treatment standpoint, right now the treatments are fairly limited. The goal with current medications that are available are to try to help the healthy parts of the brain to work as well as possible. With a condition like Alzheimer's disease, you've lost some of your brain cells and the connections that they have to other cells. So that makes it more difficult to think in the way that you used to. But some of your cells and the cell networks or connections are still healthy and functioning. So the medications that we have now, the goal is to help those healthy circuits and cells work as well as possible. And that doesn't change the ultimate outcome in terms of the disease process. The disease is still happening in that person's brain, even if they're taking the medication. But because we are helping their brain to try to function a little bit better, we can see their day-to-day functioning stabilize or maybe level off for a period of time, which is really important because that can keep them at a more independent level for a longer period of time, which is really valuable when you're losing those things. Unfortunately, right now there is not a cure or a way to reverse the changes from Alzheimer's disease. So that is a disappointing aspect of treatment.
But it sort of segues right into the care part of it. And I guess that would be a way to talk. What resources are there for families in the region who need help?
The ADRC is sort of hopefully the one-stop kind of shop to be able to identify what the needs are and to be able to provide information and assistance about all the services that are available for that person. So we can provide information about home-delivered meals, about transportation. We can provide information on private pay sources, private pay for home care needs, so cooking, cleaning, medication management, those types of things. We also do what's called a long-term care functional screen for people that need long-term care and need help paying for those services. So we now have in this area Family Care and IRIS, which are the long-term care programs. So we do the initial assessment for those programs, and then if someone qualifies, they have to qualify both functionally and financially to meet those standards to be able to get publicly funded help. We do a lot of referrals to the clinics. We do referrals to the Alzheimer's Association. We have lots of different resources and things that we have available. We purchase books through the Alzheimer's Association. It's called Coach Royal's Playbook, which I really, really like. It talks about the early stages, the middle stages, the end stages, what to expect, and it's in very plain language, so it's an easy read. We also have all kinds of resources that I've gotten from the National Institute on Health, different handouts, brochures, booklets about different types of dementia, Lewy body dementia, and other things, Alzheimer's, that we can give out as resources. We brainstorm with people to figure out what choices, what options they have. So we do a lot of that options counseling kinds of things to see what is available, what the needs are, maybe what the needs will be in the future, so we can kind of plan ahead so that there aren't real emergencies. We help with all kinds of things like alarms on the doors for someone that's wandering. You know, we can help with those kinds of adaptive kinds of equipment and things to alert people about what's going on so that their loved one doesn't wander out into the woods and get lost, kind of thing.
Oh, go ahead.
I think one thing I would add is I refer folks to the Alzheimer's Association, not just for information about what to expect, and they certainly have that, and it's wonderful. I think I also, as much, refer people to that group and other organizations in order to get connected with a community of other caregivers. Because I, as a healthcare professional, I can tell you about your disease and what to expect and what things are going to happen. But I think there's a lot of collective wisdom in those communities of caregivers where they can share ideas about how they've addressed issues that are coming up. So how did people help their loved one with medications when that became an issue? And I think I can think of ideas too, but people that are living that day to day, I think, can come up with more creative or more effective ways. And so I think it's really great to get connected with that community, both to support yourself, but also to get some of that information from other people who are living with the same kinds of challenges or changes in their loved one's functioning.
Julie, you've been very quiet. The Alzheimer's Association is a key place for people to go, right?
Yeah, we provide a lot of services here in the community, and I think one that Dr. Keenan is kind of alluding to that I want to make sure we take a moment to point out, and that is the support groups that we have available in our communities here in the Northwoods. And, you know, people hear that word support group and might get a little turned off by just what we call it. But I'm a big proponent and advocate for that peer-to-peer support where people who are affected by this, whether it's a parent or a spouse or a neighbor, if they're struggling with, you know, what is happening, how to help, feeling frustrated, feeling alone, the support groups are a great opportunity for those caregivers to get together with other people and realize there are other people in that same boat. And we have a lot to learn from one another. So sharing experiences, sharing wisdom, sharing knowledge, what's working, what's not working, what resources in the community are out there. And I find that caregivers will say, well, you know, you told me about someone who could come into my home and help with cleaning, but it wasn't until somebody recommended it at the support group that I really took it serious. So it's when they hear it from someone else who's in their shoes that they really understand that there are resources out there to help. I also believe those support groups are just a great place for caregivers to have a safe place to be able to go and just really say, life is tough right now. This is hard. This is painful. This is not what I thought my retirement was going to be like. This is not how I expected things to look for us. And be with people who can validate them and say, yes, we hear what you're saying and we understand. So it's that safe place to be able to go. I hear stories too all the time about how the caregivers also value those support groups because they also laugh. And so they find themselves in some really awkward situations, making strange decisions that they never thought that they would have to make for their loved one, that, you know, they feel a little bit put off that, oh, I can't believe I'm laughing about this, but they get that validation from their peers also. It's okay to laugh. It's okay to see the humor in these situations that sometimes come up. Along that lines, too, with the support groups, we also have memory cafes across the Northwoods, which is a great opportunity for people who are affected by Alzheimer's or other types of dementia to be able to get out into the community, to be socially engaged with other people. Kind of the nature of the beast with dementia is we see people becoming very socially isolated, not just the person with the disease, but also the caregivers. We see their social networks start to shrink and shrink just at the time when what they really need is that social interaction to be able to be with other people. So the Memory Cafe is a concept that it's a place where the caregiver and that person with dementia can go together and connect with other people and have fun and drink coffee and visit and do fun activities together. So we work real closely with some of the memory cafes in the Northwoods community. I'm going to talk a lot here. I get real excited about my work. I'm sorry. But we also do another support for family are the community education classes that we do. So we have some that are very general for people who are just looking to learn more about Alzheimer's and what it is. But we also have very specific caregiver classes that we offer. So if families have gotten a diagnosis and they've gotten some information, but they need more more instruction, more education. We do hold those classes regularly across the Greater Wisconsin chapter. And so we encourage families to seek out those education classes. And even if they're not comfortable coming to them in person, they're also available online through the Alzheimer's Association website at alz.org. Real easy to remember, so you can take them at home in your pajamas where you're nice and warm and comfortable. But it is important to know that, you know, in addition to just being an information and referral where people can call with questions, we also have great resources that can help caregivers connect to one another in those various ways.
We have just a few minutes left to go. There's one question I wanted to bring up, stigmas and barriers that are often seen, especially for families living in rural Wisconsin. Who wants to take that one? Julie?
Well, I can honestly say I've been involved in dementia care for, I'm going to date myself here, over 20 years, so let's not do the math and try to figure out how old Julie is. But I know that when I first started working for the Alzheimer's Association and I would go to a health fair, people would kind of walk past me and not make eye contact, not glance at the table. It's if she doesn't see me, she won't talk to me and I won't have to talk to her kind of thing. And I would say, you know, in the last few years, what has happened now is we see people stopping at the table. Everybody has a story to tell. my mom had Alzheimer's, my husband has Alzheimer's, my neighbor is starting to have trouble. And I think for a long time there was a stigma with Alzheimer's. It was something that we were very embarrassed about. If we can't remember things, that's not something that we're going to talk about. But I think with the number of people who are affected by Alzheimer's, and especially with our aging population here in the Northwoods, we're starting to realize that it's a disease process. It's an illness. It's not something that anyone can choose whether they're going to get or not, or have any degree of control over getting. And so we're starting to see, I think, that stigma start to erase a little bit, but I think it still is. We're in a rural community. Towns are very small, and people tend to still be very private about the issues that they're having and disclosing a diagnosis. I think over time, hopefully, we will see that stigma start to get to be less and less, even more than it already has. But I can honestly say I think it's better now than it was years ago.
Colette, has that been your finding too?
Oh, yeah, I have to agree. I think, again, because of the population aging, more people are becoming aware, but also, you know, the baby boom generation has taken the initiative to be self-aware. They do a lot of research. They're looking for answers. They want to have a say in their life, and they want to drive what their options are. So I think it's become a little bit more of a normal thing to talk about, instead of something that we hide from, and people are a little bit more open about talking about symptoms or identifying concerns. Certainly we still have some people, even our baby boomers that are in the sandwich generation, where they're caring for elder parents while still raising younger kids, and so their needs are a little bit different too, as far as they want to find resources. We have a lot of family members who are out of town, out of state, and so they tend to do a lot more research online, a lot more communication via email and things like that. So I think it's something that people are just a little bit more comfortable talking about and exploring options.
In a nutshell, what can we do to keep our brains as healthy as possible for as long as possible? Dr. Keenan, you want to start?
Sure. I think a couple of things. One would be to take as best care as you can of your vascular health. So when I say that, I mean how your heart is doing, how your lungs are doing. And the reason that you want to take care of those things is because they indirectly affect your brain. Now, having vascular problems like high blood pressure isn't going to directly cause you to have Alzheimer's disease. But what those conditions can do over time is to affect the resilience of your brain to be healthy and to do the things that it needs to do. And so the better care that people take of their brain, the more resilient that they are to any changes from something like Alzheimer's disease. So taking good care of your heart. I think also thinking about what I would call your cognitive diet, or the diet of activities that you give your brain to do. And just like in everyday life, we try not to eat the same things every day, and we try not to eat junk food all the time, it's good to give your brain different things to do. So that means being somewhat social, giving yourself something pleasantly challenging to do, keeping your brain active. That's really helpful as well. You don't have to do things that you hate to do or eat things that you hate to eat, but finding something that you enjoy. So for some people, that's reading a somewhat challenging book, or learning a language, or doing puzzles. I think also the last thing I would mention is exercise. You don't need to get out and run a marathon, but even just basic things like walking and things that are going to take good care of your overall health are going to help to protect you against conditions like Alzheimer's disease in the long run.
And all of those things are things that they do at the senior center. They have exercise classes. They have puzzles. They have game nights. They play mahjong. They play cribbage. So there's the social stuff. There's the congregate meals, so people can come and have those. You know, there's all different sorts of things that are exactly what Dr. Keenan was talking about that you can do right at the senior center.
And not to be scary or threatening, but I see as many patients who have not taken good care of their vascular health and have changes of their brain in their brain from those conditions as I do with Alzheimer's disease. So these are things that can really impact how we're doing and functioning over the long term. So seeking out prevention and really seeking health and resilience in those areas can really pay dividends as you move into your 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Well, in the moments we have left, I guess let's go around the table and talk about your organization and where people can get more information if they heard something today.
Well, the Alzheimer's Association, one of the easiest ways to access us is, I will say, through our website, because it's the easiest one for me to say on the radio and have people actually remember. So if they just go to alz.org/GWWI, they can access our local website. But the Alzheimer's Association does have an office here in Rhinelander, so we're available on a local level. And we also have a toll-free helpline that people can access. But I would encourage them to get that information off the website, just because that's a little bit easier on the radio than to me to list off a whole bunch of numbers for people.
Jennifer?
Well, they can stop in at any of the ADRC offices. We also have a website that has a wealth of information, and that's ADRCofthenorthwoods.org. And yes, it's long, but it's all spelled out. Don't forget the S on Northwoods. They can also contact the Commission on Aging, Department on Aging in their counties, and they also have resources where they can direct them and get them hooked up with the home-delivered meals, transportation, those types of things.
I think in terms of our services, and I'm referring to myself and Colette, is that, you know, those are medical services. And so the best thing to do, I think, if you have concerns about your memory and you're wondering if you would need to consult with a professional or group like us, it would be to talk to your primary care doctor.
Well, that's all the time we have for the program. So but before we go, let's go around and say your names and your titles one more time so people can know who they heard in this last hour.
I'm Julie St. Pierre. I'm a community outreach specialist with the Alzheimer's Association Greater Wisconsin Chapter.
Jennifer Sackett, ADRC specialist with the ADRC of the Northwoods.
Colette Sunk, community resources social worker, Marshfield Clinic, Minocqua Center.
I'm Dr. Peter Keenan. I'm a clinical neuropsychologist with Marshfield Clinic based out of Minocqua.
And I'm Ken Krall, and thank you for listening.